This is a Power 98.7 podcast. Now we're talking. Subscribe to Power 98.7 podcasts in iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. There's more on power987.co.za.
We delve into the stories behind the headlines. It's time for an update, a review of the weekend headlines, and an analysis of the back story. And yes, I now understand what one of our esteemed listeners was saying when he said, Lerato, who's Rulani Baloyi? I didn't get it. Yes, okay, so the coach for Mamelodi Sundowns, which won 5-2 against Al Ahly, congratulations, congratulations, congratulations. Their coach is Rulani Mokoena. I used to work with a really accomplished journalist, Rulani Baloyi, who was for the longest time a legal journalist at SABC and ultimately became a presenter of a TV show at SABC. And I think I just channeled her in my mind. So shout out to Rulani Baloyi, great journo, and shout out to Rulani Mokoena, great coach. And shout out to Dr. Candace Bailey, journalist and strategic initiatives editor at The Conversation. Good morning.
Good morning, Lerato. How are you?
Fine, thank you. Thanks so much for coming through. So there are a lot of things you want to focus our minds on this morning. Let's start off with the report, News 24 City Press, the airport and the corrupt cops. What is this story about?
It's quite a strange story, Lerato. I must be honest with you. It's about a three-year investigation that's been running into corrupt cops that have been stationed at OR Tambo Airport. Now, there are about 17 police officers that 3 years ago they were arrested for being involved in a drug cartel, essentially. Mm. And it appears that 3 years later they are still on the cops' payroll. They're still on the state's payroll. They're still stationed at OR Tambo, and it's really just quite alarming that it seems that they just can't get out of the system. It looks like they're going to be having a disciplinary hearing later in March, on the 21st of March, which I think is next week. So they'll be appearing before an internal disciplinary hearing. But I think the gist of the story that's really concerning for us as citizens is that these cops are still stationed at the airport. They're still there. They haven't been able to get them out. There's at least 20, there's a docket of 20 corruption cases, yeah, and 233 charges of corruption that are linked to the criminal activities of these cops. I mean, these are the people who are defending the law. So, yeah, they are protecting us. So it's concerning that, you know, things are still happening at the airport and they're still there. So, I mean, I think that's just a bit of a...
Yeah, the backstory. So here's what I was wondering when I saw it. I thought to myself, well, technically they are members of the South African Police Services stationed at the airport, which is an AXA space, and AXA has its own security, and then there's also immigration police. So ultimately, who has authority over the policing responsibilities at the airport? Surely it can't be blamed on not that they are, but it can't be blamed on AXA. It still falls within the police to deploy the right caliber of men in uniform to the police, to the airport.
Completely, completely, Lerato. The buck stops with the cops. The buck stops with the National Police Service. And that's where we really need to be thinking about the vetting that happens in terms of cops, how they are vetted, what processes they undergo to, you know, to be able to form part of our ranks. I mean, that's really a big issue for us, you know. There's been, over the years, lots of focuses on corruption within the ranks of the cops. Mm. But it's not only, you know, they always say that the fish rots from the head. But,
absolutely,
you know, also means that you are having other cops in the service. And like you're saying, AXA, it's an airport. It's an international affair. So you're having lots of people coming in. There's sort of like the first point of call. If a criminal is coming into our country, that's where we need to be able to stop them.
Yeah.
And what's happening is you're having corrupt cops that are in those ranks who are obviously taking money, stealing drugs, etc. It's quite a harrowing story.
And it explains, with all due respect, why a man carrying almost $500,000 in cash can just walk through an airport building without being apprehended, because that's where some of this wrongdoing begins.
Exactly. I mean, exactly. It just shows that there's absolutely no regard for the law. And that is a bit concerning, to be honest with you.
Okay. And I just wanted to point out the AXA thing, because when you're sitting in an airport building, you're thinking, where is airport security? But it's subcontracted, you know, by the police to the airport. And ultimately, these investigations have to happen at police headquarters, and the crimes are being perpetrated in this multinational space called the airport. Okay, there's also the mysterious case of the executive mayor of Tshwane, his short-lived tenure, firstly because he had not made proper disclosures about his insolvency status, you know, which I think we could be sensitive about, you know, people do go through ups and downs financially. But then the alleged falsified document to prove he'd undergone a thorough debt review and rehabilitation. So this is where the problem really is. This is the nub of the thing, is the fraud in getting a document that isn't properly certified to prove that he's worthy of the seat, and it turns out he's not. So, my gosh.
Well, there are two parts to this, Lerato. You have to remember that, you know, in order to hold a position within any level of our government, you can't be declared insolvent. You can't be a financial risk. And that's obviously very important, because you don't want somebody who potentially has a challenge, you know, being in a position where they can, they're in a position of power, they've got access to lots of money. So you don't want to create that scenario. So, I mean, I understand the law on that front. But the fact that you falsified documents, wow, that's absolutely crazy. And that you, I mean, you are a really high-ranking official. I mean, if you think about it, on a local government level, the mayor is sits right at the top of the of the food chain. So if you can lie about something like this, what else can you lie about? And I mean, I think that that's very concerning. Very interesting the approach that COPE has taken, you know, to not only just remove him from their ranks, but also remove him from their party. But the question is, you know, where were the checks and balances in the first place? Maybe they should have had these checks and balances right at the beginning. So what is the vetting process? A lot about vetting processes that we're talking about today, but where are the vetting processes that they undergo in terms of appointing a person as a councillor? You know, surely there should be more careful regard for the people that we want to lead our cities.
And I think you've said two very important things. So what I've learned, believe it or not, being on the show with the series we did on municipalities, is that actually budgeting for a city council happens at the executive, mayoral and mayoral council level. So even a city manager and CFO, they get their instructions on disbursement from the mayor.
It's
a completely different system to how it works at national government, where the treasury decides this and then you've got to... No, the mayor tells you how 77 billion rands of the city of Johannesburg's money will be spent. So that's an incredibly powerful position. And as you say, a mayor who may have had financial challenges in the past then presents an integrity risk, because if they are debt ridden and they see this money, what are the temptations? That's just the assumption of the protocol. This is why people have to be vetted. But the vetting should have happened a long time ago, not just at the moment that his name was put up to be the replacement mayor for the other mayor who had to step down. And it should have been something that his party had vetted before even making him a councillor, let alone a speaker of the council. So the mere fact that the process got this far, Candace, without his financial records being known, tells you that there are so many cracks in the system.
Yeah, it just talks about the space that local government is in our country, and the gaps, the problem that we're seeing. And I mean, I think we're seeing it as citizens all over our country, we're seeing it in terms of how our municipalities are being run. There are cracks, there are gaps, there are cracks. There are lots of challenges that, you know, city ratepayers are feeling the pinch with. So. It really speaks to the bigger issue around our municipalities.
But what speaks to his integrity is the falsified document. That one can't be blamed on COPE or the council or anybody. That one is him.
That's quite a scary issue, that somebody would go to that length to try and get to power.
And apparently now the question is whether the Hawks need to investigate him further and indict him for falsifying this rehabilitation certificate, because that's a straight ethical issue on his conscience and nobody else's. Okay. Other issues on our conscience collectively is the state of disaster. And there are many concerns, Candace Bailey, that if you don't devise the right kinds of protocols, this opens itself up to a lot of flouting of processes and even corruptibility of the system, and another kind of a procurement disaster that awaits us. So we are looking for an intervention on electricity, but if a new minister is given wanton, you know, is given rules with reckless abandon, many things can go wrong on the procurement side.
Completely. I mean, I think we all were shocked and horrified when, in the middle of the COVID pandemic, and you know, our minds may have allowed us to forget about it, but in the middle of the COVID pandemic, 2020, we saw the massive procurement bungle. At government, billions of rands that were stolen in terms of the sale of, well, the purchasing of PPE, etc. And that's exactly what we're trying to avoid in this instance. And I think what the concern is, particularly from civil society organizations, is that by President Cyril Ramaphosa putting in the Disaster Management Act, putting in the laws in the way that he has, people will actually have free rein to do what they want in terms of creating, you know, procurement. Well, first of all, it's creating a procurement gap, and second of all, it's creating sort of putting big holes in the levels of accountability and the mechanisms of accountability that should exist when this happens. I mean, I understand that the president feels that, you know, we should be able to have, as if we have a state of disaster around electricity, we would be able to move things a lot faster, which I think that there's a concern for not only ordinary citizens, for businesses that have suffered significantly during the, as a result of the electricity crisis.
I wonder if you can help us, Dr. Candace Bailey, in just, I know that the rules are still being devised, there's nothing concrete yet, that's my understanding, but what are the sort of emergency powers that would be required in handling this disaster called the electricity crisis in the country? What are the sorts of interventions that need to happen without too much bureaucracy? Because that's effectively the powers that are being given to a minister.
I mean, to be honest with you, I, as an ordinary citizen, I looked at the papers that's written and I thought exactly the same thing. What would we need to be pushing so quickly that we can't, you know, take a few days to think about it or a few weeks to think about it? So as far as I understand, and the civil society group, the Procurement Reform Working Group, have been quite vocal about speaking about the level of free rein that ministers will have as a result of the state of disaster. And one of the things that they've said is that, according to basically, members of the executive will have unlimited discretion to make, to not only sign off regulations, but also to sign off procurement deals that they think they may need going forward. So, I mean, that's concerning on its own. I think that even if we, and I think as ordinary citizens, we often think, but what does that mean? Yeah. You know, what does it mean for us? I mean, are you going to, it's not like they're going to be pushing out light bulbs, you know, battery operated light bulbs, to signing off battery operated light bulbs to everybody. So, I mean, what is the level of regulations that they want to put in? I mean, I understand, and this is based on what the president said in the State of the Nation address, was that, you know, they wanted to deal with rebates, for example, for businesses who had, for example, gotten solar.
The incentives to put up panels, incentives, and they'll get some rebates.
That's not something that's immediate. That's not something that I see as an emergency. You know, even if you think of all the things that they would need to implement, I don't see them as a specific emergency in the sense that when I think of an emergency, I think of it has to happen in the next 1 minute, and it needs to happen now. It's a matter of life and death.
So I'm just thinking of it in a healthcare context, for instance. If there's a crisis like COVID and you need more doctors on payroll, that's saying, no, the contracts for doctors will be issued today and will be finalized this afternoon. We don't need long processes of recruiting doctors. They can all enter at this salary scale. That's an emergency power because there is a crisis. So it needs to be that sort of thing around engineers coming into the system, et cetera, et cetera. If it's on procurement, big programs, power stations, that's another thing altogether.
Exactly. I mean, and I think that there are good parts to it, Lerato, and you're right. For example, the fact that there will be certain types of facilities that will be sort of free of load shedding. For example, hospitals will be free of load shedding, and that's one of the procurement, one of the regulations that they will put into place. I mean, that's also a once-off regulation. So I think that there are parts of it that make sense, but parts of it that you think, I mean, does this fall under an emergency regulation?
Yeah. Okay.
I think there's questions around,
especially a power station that's going to take 4 years to build, not an emergency, because clearly you're not going to roll out the electricity today. Okay, we're in conversation with Dr. Candace Bailey.
Send us your voice notes on 083-303-7093.
We're in conversation with Dr. Candace Bailey, journalist and strategic initiatives editor at The Conversation. And we're having a conversation about the stories in the headlines. So, Dr. Bailey, pala pala, they say the president dodged a bullet. Did he, when it's really a provisional report?
Yeah, technically, you're absolutely right. We can't say they dodged the bullet yet, but the indications are that he dodged the bullet based on the draft report that was sent out to the people who had actually made the complaint to the Office of the Public Protector. That is the African Transformation Movement, Vuyo Nungula. So, I mean, I think we obviously have to wait and see until the final report comes in. But based on what I see, what I've read about the report coming out and about sort of what they're saying is that the president was actually not at fault on two fronts. One is that he wasn't running the day-to-day, the operations of the farm, if you can put it that way. So, I mean, they basically saying that he was cleared because he had declared within his executive ethics code that he did have the farm. And also then saying that, you know, it wasn't his fault in terms of the way the investigation ran. He did what he needed to do by reporting it to the head of the police protection unit. At the farm, and that they actually didn't follow processes. So obviously, once again, they're putting the blame on the cops.
On Vali Ruut and so-called Benji Chauke.
Exactly. So obviously making them answer the tricky questions now and not the president. And you would remember that the National Assembly had a Section 89 inquiry report where they also earlier this year, towards the end of last year really,
blocked a vote.
It blocked the vote and also just sort of cleared him of any irregularity on that front. So it does look like he is getting off in this instance.
And it's curious to me that Arthur Fraser hasn't made a submission, and yet he apparently in his documents with the police when he opened the docket, he has video evidence, there's anecdotal evidence, the helper who allegedly orchestrated the crime with her brother gives testimony as to the president himself bribing them to go away from this issue with 150,000. So none of those people were called to give evidence.
And in fact, if you've read the City Press article, you'd see that it says that, you know, Arthur Fraser not submitting the evidence and disclosing the sources of the information was actually part of the reason why the president is now being cleared, because they weren't able to utilize the evidence that he initially brought or the allegations that he initially brought and see if there were any fruit to those allegations. So, I mean, it's quite an interesting battle. I mean, it does speak about the times we're living in terms of the political turmoil that we're in and the factional battles, the fights, and, you know, whether or not they just needed at a specific point in time to have a specific red flag around a specific person.
Yeah, and my understanding is that if Arthur Fraser was to bring that evidence, he'd have to declare how he got it.
Exactly.
And that's perhaps also where there's a double criminality, perhaps.
Yeah.
Okay. SABC minister said to have meddled in the selection of the board, and this is why perhaps at the moment the president hasn't been able to sign in this board and the SABC is functioning without a board. What is going on here?
Oh, gosh. Such a long-running story. So just to give your listeners a little bit of background, just in case they forgot, Patiswa Magupeni was the former HR head of news at SABC. She was fired in last year, I think it was in January last year, after the disciplinary process. And at the center of it was the fact that she had allowed a special assignment show that was supposed to be interdicted. She'd allowed it to go ahead. They then cited a breakdown of trust in the relationship, and that's they then led to an entire disciplinary hearing on her. Turns out that she's now been appointed, nominated
to the
on
board,
the board, and she's one of 12 people that's been nominated on the board. The National Assembly signed off this list in December last year, and the president is really just supposed to, you know, put his signature on the dotted line to finalize the entire process, because it's actually a parliamentary process. It's not a process that's run by the president. He really just, you know, officiates the process. And it turns out that the former minister of communications had put her finger in the pie to ask some questions that it seems like she shouldn't have asked. But we also should tell you that, or just remind your listeners, is that there is also Media Monitoring Africa, which is a media watchdog, has taken the president to the Constitutional Court. Now, they filed papers about a week or two ago, and they are set to go to court, saying that the president cannot delay the signing in of these board members again. So So obviously they are trying to put pressure on him. They've given him a deadline, I think until the 12th of February, to sign in those board members. It appears that there's just some delay. We're not sure what the delay is, but clearly it may be the former communication minister that created the problem.
Okay, so this is the allegation that Khumbudzo Ntshavheni interfered by saying perhaps is there a problem appointing a former head of news who was at loggerheads with the CEO and the then chair, and that could have created a hurdle unnecessarily so in the process. And you can't have a state-owned enterprise, which is what the SABC is effectively running, without a fiduciary overhead role known as the board. Thanks, Dr. Candace Bailey. Great to speak to you, and we hope to do it again soon. She is the Strategic Initiatives Editor at The Conversation. Time for the news.
You've been listening to a Power 98.7 podcast. For more podcasts, visit power987.co.za or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.